The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hey there, friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today's episode covers the machete murderer, Juan Corona. Corona began his life in Mexico, but eventually made his way to Yuba City, California in the 1950s. He worked as a farmer with a large orchard and gained a reputation as a reliable and hardworking man. He had a family and eventually became a labor contractor. He had a large group of men that he would contract out to ranchers to pick fruit. What no one knew was that Corona had a very sadistic streak. He would often pick out members of his crew who were owed money, take them to an isolated area on his land, and stab them to death. And because most of the men who worked for Corona were transients or migrant workers, no one questioned their disappearances. It was not uncommon for men to leave suddenly, to move on to a new job, and with no explanation. It wasn't until May 19, 1971, when a farmer with a nearby peach orchard was out inspecting his orchard and noticed a hole that had been dug that was approximately the size that one would dig for a grave. It was odd, but this man wouldn't become seriously concerned until he returned later and saw that the hole had been filled in. So he contacted the sheriff, and what they discovered in the hole was the body of a man who had been stabbed and beaten about the head. Further searches over the next 2 weeks would uncover 25 bodies. Most of them had paper receipts made out to Juan Corona on their person, which ultimately led to Corona's arrest. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Juan Corona was born in Mexico in 1934. He had an older brother named Natividad who moved to the United States when Juan was just 10 years old, and he eventually followed his brother to California, migrating in the 1950s in search of work. Natividad had opened a successful cafe while Juan found work on various farms harvesting carrots and melons in the Imperial Valley near the U.S.-Mexico border. He stayed in the area for about 3 months before deciding to move north to the Sacramento Valley in order to find another job bringing in crops. For the next few years, Juan continued to work on various farms, and he eventually got married in Reno in 1953. As he continued to work, now living in the Yuba City area, he became known as reliable and hardworking. Right before Christmas in 1955, there was a really bad rainstorm that lasted nearly 2 weeks. It caused massive flooding, tons of damage to the surrounding area, and it also claimed the lives of 38 people who drowned when a levee holding the Yuba and Feather Rivers broke and unleashed thousands of gallons of water and flooded an area of 150 square miles. After the rain and flooding subsided, Juan's wife noticed that he was different. Juan, quote, believed everyone had died in the flood and that he was living in a land of ghosts. Juan spent most of his free time during this period reading the Bible, end quote. He was clearly distraught over the effects of the flooding, and so on January 11, 1956, Natividad, quote, filed a petition in Yuba County Superior Court asking that his half-brother be committed to a mental hospital, end quote. In less than a week, Juan was sent to DeWitt State Hospital, located in Auburn, California, and underwent a psychiatric evaluation. The doctors diagnosed him with schizophrenia on January 17th, and the following day he began treatment, which included 23 electroconvulsive therapy sessions. Once the treatment was completed, doctors felt confident that Juan was ready to re-enter society, so they released him, but he was almost immediately deported back to Mexico. Outwardly, he seemed to be doing better. He continued to work wherever he could find it. At one point, with Natividad's help, Juan returned to the United States with a green card, legally clearing him to work. He also gave up drinking around this same time. However, more than once over the next couple of years, he would go around telling people that he was sick in the head and needed help, and told this repeatedly to one woman in particular, a Mrs. Lillard. Now, up until now, aside from his stay in the DeWitt State Hospital, there doesn't seem to be any evidence to show that he received any additional treatment or help with what he said was sickness in the head. His relationship with Natividad became increasingly strained, to say the least, during this period. They apparently barely spoke to each other, and Natividad grew more and more concerned about his younger brother. In 1960, Juan got married again, this time to a woman named Gloria Moreno, and they had a daughter, Martha. As the years passed, Juan continued to build his reputation for his work. Towards the mid-1960s, he began occasionally contracting out a crew to local farmers. Most of his crews consisted of migrant workers, transients, men looking for any kind of income, and it wasn't unusual for the men in these crews to change often. The workers would move on or find another way to earn a living. And when Juan was approximately 29 years old, he ran into this Mrs. Lillard again and asked her to help him bury, quote, wino garbage, end quote. And for whatever reason, she agreed. And apparently, allegedly, I can't find any sources to actually verify this, so this could just be complete and total rumor. But allegedly, she accompanied him as he buried something. I think we can all imagine what that something was. He probably started murdering people back in the 1960s, and no one really realized it. And whether or not this Mrs. Lillard exists, like I said, may or may not be true. But if she does exist, I'm guessing she didn't ask what. But when he was finished with burying this wino garbage, so he said, he apparently became agitated and didn't want her to leave because he was afraid that she would go and tell his brother Natividad or his other brother Felix, who had also migrated to the United States. A couple of years later, in 1965, even Juan's wife Gloria went to this Mrs. Lillard and confessed that she was deeply concerned about her husband, that he was sick and he needed help. But like I said, couldn't find much information on who Mrs. Lillard was, but it seems like she may have had a pretty good idea about what was wrong with Juan Corona, and yet it doesn't seem like she ever did anything about it or told anyone about it. At this point, I would say that his behavior is definitely alarming. He's already asked her to go out in the middle of the night and help him bury something. His wife has come to her saying that his behavior is worrisome. And regardless of what he buried, that's not exactly what I would call normal behavior. You don't go out into the middle of the night to bury something unless you don't want anyone to see you burying whatever this is. In 1966, Juan obtained a pretty lucrative contract for the Sullivan Ranch. He contracted out some of his crews to help with the harvest, and despite however much he made from booking that contract, he paid his workers as little as possible and apparently housed them all in a building on the ranch. The building and living conditions were, I guess, pretty comparable to what you imagine army barracks to be like. Perhaps army barracks years and years ago. I don't know what they're like these days, but that image of a very bare building, just bunks and beds, no bells and whistles, that's what it sounds like he had set up for them. A lot of the men he had working for him were elderly. Some had substance abuse issues, some were men who didn't quite fit into society, and as we've seen time and again, people who are unfortunately in that kind of station in life are often targeted by those with malicious intents because of how easy it is for them to disappear without causing any concern. By 1969, Corona's business was booming. He had contracted another crew to the Johnson Ranch to help pick olives. And around this time, he also started to gain a reputation as someone not to be messed with. He apparently beat up a man named Riley Smith, who had been sent to the Sullivan Ranch to inspect some of the vehicles that were used and pretty much just make sure everything was in proper working condition and that all regulations and safety standards were being adhered to. Corona became frustrated with some of the questions that Smith asked him and physically lashed out at the man, who was simply just there to do his job. He just wanted to do his job, but Corona got mad and beat him up for it. In February 1970, there was another violent attack, but this time it was allegedly the work of Juan's brother, Natividad, and happened inside his cafe. On February 25th, a man named Romero Reya was found around 1 in the morning inside the bathroom of the cafe. He had been beaten and slashed on the face and head, and also showed signs of having been sexually assaulted. Natividad called the police and was shocked when Reya turned around and identified him as the attacker. Natividad was gay, and because it occurred in his cafe, he was the one ultimately accused of the attack and was sued by Reya for $250,000. The stress of this accusation caused Natividad to suffer a mental breakdown, and he soon moved back to Mexico. Here's my issue with this. I came across several sources that seem to blatantly and without question accuse Natividad of this attack. And it seems like it was just because of the fact that he was a gay man. Natividad had shown no prior signs of violence, and Reya showed signs of sexual assault. But just because a person is gay doesn't mean they're violent, sexually or otherwise. When Natividad fled to Mexico to escape the allegations, the case remained unresolved. No one was ever charged or convicted of Reya's attack, and despite Juan being the one who had shown aggression to others in the past, like the attack on Riley Smith, he wasn't even so much as questioned. And yes, hindsight is 20/20. Looking at it now, it would make so much sense to question Juan Corona about this, being the brother of the man accused and most likely someone who had access to the cafe. At the very least, ask him if he had seen or heard anything, but that's not what happened. All right, friends, I'm going to take a short break, so hang tight. I'll be right back. Okay, friends, welcome back. Just a month after the attack on Romero Reya, Juan Corona was sent back to DeWitt State Hospital and remained there for an undetermined amount of time. The following year, work was scarce. The harvesting industry was becoming more and more mechanized, and Juan found himself in a predicament. Without the anticipated earnings from his contracts, his income had almost completely diminished to nothing, which put additional stress on him when it came to providing for his family. In March 1971, he applied for welfare but was rejected because the state of California believed, quote, he had too many assets, two houses, and some cash in the bank, end quote. No doubt this enraged Juan. With very few contracts coming in, he had no income. He was unable to pay the men he had hired. He was unable to use them on a crew. And over the next couple of months, these men began to slowly disappear. And these men were drifters, transients, men whose absence wouldn't be noticed. And nobody realized what was happening until it was too late. On May 19th, 1971, a man named Goro Kagehiro was walking through his peach orchard when he noticed a hole had been dug between two trees. He also noticed that one of Corona's crews were working nearby, so he really didn't think much of the hole after that. That is until he returned later that evening and noticed that the hole had been filled in, and that when filled in, it resembled somewhat a gravesite. Kagehiro called the sheriff's office, and Deputy Sheriff Steve Sizelove came out to take a look, and since it was on Kagehiro's land, he authorized them to excavate the hole, and as they dug, they uncovered the body of Kenneth Whitaker. Kenneth had been sexually assaulted, stabbed in the chest, and the back of the skull had been split open with an axe or a large knife, at least twice. Police also allegedly found homosexual pornography in his pocket, but it was never determined if it belonged to him or his attacker. With the discovery of Whitaker's body, law enforcement began to search the rest of the orchards nearby, and over the next 5 days, they uncovered the remains of 9 men all buried in similar graves, including Charles Fleming, Melford Sample, and John Henry Jackson. Their bodies had been mutilated and showed signs of sexual assault. Their shirts were pulled up over their heads, and most were either not wearing pants or their pants had been pulled down. Each of the men had been hit in the back of the head, just like Kenneth Whitaker. As each of the bodies were examined, police also found receipts made out to Juan Corona on almost every single one, which gave authorities a clear direction of who to look at for a suspect. The following day, a search warrant was signed by Judge Houck for police to search the building on Sullivan Ranch where Corona housed his crew, as well as Corona's house and his garage. Altogether, deputies confiscated 27 items for evidence, including a bloodstained machete, knives, articles of clothing, a ledger with names of what police determined were the victims, and various tools. A search of Corona's truck revealed blood in the bed. Juan Corona was placed under arrest on 9 counts of murder based on the evidence found on the bodies, as well as what they had found during their search. Teams continued to search the orchards and nearby fields and recovered 3 more bodies on May 26th and 11 on May 27th, bringing the total victims to 23. 2 more bodies would be found a little less than a week later on June 2nd, connected to Juan Corona once again because he had left 2 receipts from Bank of America with his name on it where the bodies were found. This brought Corona's total to 25 men with ages ranging from 40 up to mid-60s. Each man had been stabbed and sliced with a large knife, and one of them had also been shot. Within 2 weeks, Corona lawyered up, with Richard Houck signing on as his attorney. Corona was questioned by police for the next month, and during this time, he began to have chest pains, and apparently the pain was so bad on June 18th that he was rushed to the hospital and believed to have had a heart attack. Corona was questioned 6 times until July 12, 1971, when he was officially charged with 25 counts of murder in the first degree. Corona spent the next 14 months awaiting trial, but in the meantime, he apparently signed over all the rights to his story, if you want to call it that. Any book, TV rights, film rights, things like that, to his attorney Richard Houck. Houck filed a request in September 1971 to change the venue of the trial, citing that his client wouldn't receive a fair trial if it took place in Sutter County, where the crimes had been committed. The court granted a writ of mandate on April 13, 1972, which ordered that the trial be moved to Solano County Courthouse in Fairfield, California. This location was over an hour away from Yuba City and deemed far enough to give Corona the fair trial he was legally entitled to. I know he doesn't deserve anything like this, but the legal system is set up to provide everyone, regardless of guilt, a fair trial. So even Juan Corona was entitled to a fair trial. The trial began on September 11th, 1972, and lasted 3 months, and that's not including the multiple weeks of jury selection. At the end of the trial in January 1973, and after 45 hours of deliberation, Juan Corona was convicted of all 25 counts of murder for the deaths of Kenneth Whitaker, Charles Fleming, Melford Sample, Donald Smith, John J. Haluka, Warren Kelly, Sigurd Biermann, William Emery Camp, Clarence Hawking, James W. Howard, Jonah R. Smallwood, Albert T. Riley, Paul B. Allen, Edward Martin Cupp, Albert Hayes, Raymond Mochache, John J. Jackson, Lloyd Wallace Wenzel, Mark Beverly Shields, Sam Bonafide, also known as Joe Caravo, and Joseph Maxek. There were also 4 men who could not be identified, and at the time, this was the biggest conviction of any known killer to date in the United States, but unfortunately, this was the early 1970s, and There were even more brutal killers waiting to make their mark on the country, like Ted Bundy, Sam Little, John Wayne Gacy, but Corona was one of the first with unfortunately, a double-digit kill number. Corona received 25 life sentences, one for each victim, and of course he immediately appealed his sentencing. During the trial and everything, apparently Richard Hawke was working on a book, and he published it in 1973 called The Burden of Proof, and it's apparently all about Corona's case. I haven't read it. I really have no inclination to read it because I feel that books like this only seem to propagandize the killers and are purely there to make money off of their crimes and therefore exploiting the victims. So I'm not going to read it, but if you're inclined, go ahead. His wife Gloria also filed for and was granted a divorce on July 30th, 1974. Not too surprisingly, Corona continued to appeal. He was determined to prove that Richard Hawke was incompetent and hadn't given him the best defense because he failed to cite Corona's schizophrenia as a reason to plead insanity. And while I will never be on Corona's side, I do agree that Richard Hawke probably did not go into this with the best of intentions for his client. He saw Corona as a meal ticket, as a way to make a quick buck by writing this book and selling it, and not to actually do the job that he was being paid to do and defend his client. Corona also tried to blame his brother Natividad for the murders because of the sexual element of the crimes. A lot of the victims had been sexually assaulted, but Natividad had been in Mexico at the time of the murders. So, of course, none of these claims really panned out for Corona, except for the incompetency of his defense team. In 1982, the courts ruled that he was granted a second trial, but it ended up the same way. He was found guilty of all 25 murders again, and this is all despite him maintaining his innocence throughout the entire process. With the second trial, the prosecution went to work again in painting a picture of what exactly would happen during each attack. That Juan Corona would pick out men from his crew that he owed money, bring them to an isolated place in an orchard, hit them with the machete, and rape them before burying their bodies. That same year, Juan Corona was attacked in prison, resulting in numerous injuries, including the loss of one of his eyes. Other inmates loathed him, and despite Corona talking a big game, guards noted that he may have done it to hide his fear from the other men in prison. One guard stated that the other inmates looked at him like he was slime. Juan Corona, considered California's most prolific serial killer at the time, would spend the rest of his life in prison, finally publicly admitting to his crimes on December 5th, 2011 during a parole hearing. Corona passed away from natural causes on March 4th, 2019 at the age of 85 at Corcoran State Prison. Okay, friends, that was Juan Corona, the machete murderer. Corona's confession was the closest he ever came to explaining why he had done what he did, and he's highly suspected of having a long history of violence, most likely committing rapes and assaults for years, going undetected before he eventually graduated to murder in the pursuit of satisfying his most vile urges. He apparently referred to his victims as winos or creeps, and also made claims that they were trespassing as a reason for why he killed them. The problem with this is that these men were known employees of Corona, even if only temporarily. So the trespassing claim doesn't hold much weight. It was also later revealed that there were previous times when Corona had become so angry over whatever that his family had to tie him up with a rope until he calmed down. That is really scary. The only way for his family to get him to regain control of his behavior and of his senses was to physically restrain him until he calmed down. Yikes. And, you know, his first trial seemed like a bit of a mess. The prosecution apparently lost key pieces of evidence. And as for his defense attorney, Richard Hawke, He failed to submit any evidence of Corona's psychological state or offer theories as to why he had committed these horrible murders. Although, for at least some of the theories, perhaps this was a good thing. In one of my sources, it stated that a psychiatrist suggested that, quote, as the spring deepened and the fruit ripened, Corona's madness increased until the climate drove him into a frenzy of murder and mutilation, so that he was compelled to kill someone each day to satisfy his bloodlust, end quote. So this psychiatrist was blaming his behavior and his psychological state on the weather. That doesn't quite seem right to me. It would make sense that because the weather would be warmer, that there would be more workers around, but to blame his actions as being driven solely by the weather being warmer seems to miss the mark for me just a tad. And I can't really believe that Richard Hawk saw Juan Corona as anything more than an opportunity for his 15 minutes of fame and a book deal, since he really did fail to perform in the best interests of his client, regardless of Corona's guilt. Mr. Hawk was actually hired by family members of Corona, and it was later revealed that his public defender, who was originally assigned to him, was going to pursue a not guilty verdict by reason of insanity, but for whatever reason, Hawk decided to take a different approach when he was hired. His blatant display of ineptitude is why in May 1978, Corona's conviction was overturned and he was granted a new trial in 1982, which rested heavily on trying to convince the jury that Juan's brother Natividad was the real killer, despite not being in California at the time of the murders. During the second trial, Corona's defense team absolutely did everything they could to make it look like his brother was the one responsible. They called him an aggressive homosexual. They brought up the attack on Romero Rea that happened inside Natividad's cafe. But despite this, again, Corona's future didn't fare any better. In both trials, the prosecution had more than enough evidence to convict him. The ledger of names, the bloodstained knives, the machete. They found Corona's clothing that had caked blood on it. There was really no attempt by Corona to distance himself from the victims. He was dumb enough to leave receipts of paper with his name on them in some of the graves. He didn't hide or get rid of any of the knives or the machete that he used. There was even evidence to suggest that Corona had planned some of the attacks when those who worked in the area later recalled seeing dugout holes periodically in the orchards that would later be filled back in. The prosecution stated that Corona took advantage of men who were desperate to make some money. He would pull his pickup truck alongside a group of men, pick out a few of them, bring them back to his farm to work them for a few days, and then kill them before he had to pay them. When he allegedly admitted what he had done during his parole hearing in 2011, he recalled everything in such a cold and dismissive manner, stating, quote, so I went and buy the machete, and then okay, I started killing when I had to kill those persons one by one, end quote. I'm so glad that he was so full of remorse for what he had done, you know, regardless of what kind of lives these men lived, these victims lived, they were still someone's son, someone's brother, perhaps a father, someone whose life mattered, and they didn't deserve to be attacked with a machete and buried under a peach tree, thrown out like yesterday's garbage. Of the 25 victims that were recovered, 14 of those unfortunately were never claimed, and again, authorities have never been able to confirm the identity of four of those men. So, the unclaimed and unidentified victims of Juan Corona actually share a gravesite and tombstone in Sutter County Cemetery, which reads, quote, here lie 14 men of the sod, four of them known only to God, end quote. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for your support and your encouragement. I hope that you're enjoying all these episodes. I hope that you're learning something. I hope that my Beyond the Mask episodes are giving you a nice little change up from my regular cases. As always, make sure to follow Mask of Sanity on all the social medias. Reach out to me if you have suggestions. I've gotten some really great suggestions lately that I'll be adding to my roster of cases that I'm going to do. And as always, my resources are in the episode notes. And if you're looking for ways to support Mask of Sanity and support victim services, I have a Patreon, a merch store, and a coffee account. So there's lots of different ways to support the show. If you're not looking to support financially, which I totally understand, this year has been so crappy for so many of us, a 5-star rating and review is always appreciated. Please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for Always Time for True Crime. The host, Julia, does a fantastic job bringing awareness to some of the most heartbreaking cases out there. She cares about the victims affected by the crimes and always presents her cases with respect and a solid foundation of research. So if you haven't already, if you don't listen to her show already, make sure you go and subscribe wherever you listen, and also leave her a 5-star rating and review. Again, thank you all so much for listening. I hope you'll join me next week when I cover the babyface killer, Leslie Eugene Warren. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hey guys, I'm Julia, the host of Always Time for True Crime. Each week, I cover a lesser-known case of murder, both solved and unsolved, disappearances, or serial killers. So if you're looking for something beyond Ted Bundy or JonBenet Ramsey, come check out Always Time for True Crime and learn about some cases you may have never heard of. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts.